lock from the bank's entrance. Thank you, Ms. Schaefer. Can you now mark for the jury where your car was located when you looked out the window and supposedly saw Lisa Trammell? She marked a spot in the middle lane that appeared to be at least 3 car lengths from the crosswalk. Thank you, Ms. Schaefer. You can return to the witness stand now. Schaefer put the marker back on the ledge and moved back to her seat. So how many cars were in front of you at the light, would you say?
At least 2, maybe 3.
What about the turn lane to your immediate left? Were there any cars there waiting to turn? She was ready for that one and wasn't going to let me trick her.
No, I had a clear view of the sidewalk.
So it was rush hour, and you're telling us there was nobody waiting in the turn lane to get to work?
Not next to me, but I was 2 or 3 cars back. There could have been someone waiting to turn, just not next to me.
I asked the judge if I could put the second board, Defense Exhibit 1B, on the easel now, and he told me to go ahead. This was another photo blow-up, but it was from ground level. It was a photo that Cisco had taken from a car window while sitting at the traffic light in the middle westbound lane of Ventura Boulevard at Cedros Avenue at 8:55 a.m. on a Monday, a month after the murder. There was a time imprint on the bottom right corner of the image. Back at the lectern, I asked Schaefer to describe what she saw.
It's a photo of that same block from the ground. There's Danny's Deli. We go there sometimes at lunch.
Yes, and do you know if Danny's is open for breakfast?
Yes, it is.
Have you ever been there for breakfast? Freeman stood to object.
Judge, I hardly see what this has to do with the witness's testimony or the elements of this trial.
Perry looked at me. If Your Honor would give me a moment, the relevance will become quite clear. Carry on, but make it quick. I refocused on Schaefer. Have you had occasion to have breakfast at Danny's, Miss Schaefer?
No, not breakfast.
But you do know that it is popular at breakfast, correct?
I really wouldn't know.
It wasn't the answer I wanted, but it was helpful. It was the first time Schaefer was being clearly evasive, purposefully avoiding the obvious confession. Jurors who picked up on this would begin to see someone who wasn't being an impartial witness, but a woman who refused to stray from the prosecution's line. Then let me ask you this. What other businesses on this block are open before 9 o'clock in the morning?
Mostly there are stores that wouldn't be open. You can see the signs in the picture.
Then what do you think accounts for the fact that every metered space in this photo is taken? Would it be customers of the deli? Freeman objected again, saying the witness was hardly qualified to answer the question. The judge agreed and sustained the objection, telling me to move on. On the Monday morning at 8:55, you claim you saw Ms. Trammell from 4 lanes away. Do you recall how many cars were parked in front of the deli and along the curb?
No, I don't.
You testified just a few moments ago, and I can have it read back to you if you wish, that you had a clear view of Lisa Trammell. Is it your testimony that there were no vehicles in the parking lane?
There may have been some cars there, but I saw her clearly.
What about traffic lanes? They were clear too?
Yes, I could see her.
You said you were running late because westbound traffic was moving very slowly because of an accident, correct?
Yes.
An accident in the eastbound lanes, right?
Yes.
So how far was traffic backed up in the eastbound lanes if the westbound lanes were backed up enough to make you 10 minutes late for work?
I don't really recall.
Perfect answer. For me. A dissembling witness always scores points for the D. Isn't it true, Miss Schaefer, that you had to look across 2 lanes of backed-up traffic, plus a full parking lane, in order to see the defendant on the sidewalk?
All I know is that I saw her. She was there.
And she was even carrying a big shopping bag, you say, correct?
That's right.
What kind of shopping bag?
The kind with handles. The kind you get in a department store.
What color was it?
It was red.
And could you tell if it was full or empty?
I couldn't tell.
And she carried this down at her side or in front of her?
Down at her side, with one hand.
You seem to have a good sense of this bag. Were you looking at the bag or the face of the woman who was carrying it?
I had time to look at both. I shook my head as I looked at my notes. Miss Schaefer, do you know how tall Miss Trammell is? I turned to my client and signaled her to stand up. I probably should have asked the judge's permission first, but I was on a roll and didn't want to hit any speed bumps. Perry said nothing.
I have no idea, Schaefer said.
Would it surprise you to know she is only 5'3"? I nodded to Lisa and she sat back down.
No, I don't think that would surprise me.
5'3", and you still picked her out across four lanes packed with cars. Freeman objected, as I knew she would. Perry sustained the objection, but I didn't need an answer for the point to be made. I checked my watch and saw it was 2 minutes before noon. I fired my final torpedo. Miss Schaefer, can you look at the photograph and point to where you see the defendant on the sidewalk? All eyes moved to the photo blow-up. Because of the line of cars in the parking lane, the pedestrians on the sidewalk were unidentifiable in the image. Freeman leapt to her feet and objected, claiming the defense was trying to sandbag the witness and the court. Perry called us to a sidebar. When we got there, he had stern words for me.
Mr. Holler, yes or no, is the defendant in the photo?
No, Your Honor.
Then you're engaged in attempting to trick the witness. That will not happen in my courtroom. Take your photo down.
Judge, I'm not trying to trick anyone. She could simply say that the defendant is not in the photo. But she clearly can't see the pedestrians on the other side of the traffic, and I'm trying to make that clear to...
I don't care what you're trying to do. Take your photo down, and if you try another move like that, you're going to find yourself in a contempt hearing at the close of business. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, Freeman said, the jury should be told that the defendant is not in the photo.
I agree. Go back.
On my way back to the lectern, I took the display boards off the easel.
Ladies and gentlemen, the judge said, let it be noted that the defendant was not in the photo that defense counsel put on display.
The jury instruction was fine with me. I still made my point. The fact that the jurors had to be told that Lisa was not in the photo underlined how hard it would have been to see and identify someone on the sidewalk. The judge told me to continue my cross-examination, and I leaned to the microphone. No further questions. I sat down and put the photo boards on the floor under the table. They had served me well. I took the hit from the judge, but it was worth it. It's always worth it if you make your point.
Chapter 23. Lisa Trammell was ecstatic about my cross-examination of Margot Schaefer. Even Herb Dahl couldn't hold back from congratulating me, as the trial was recessed for lunch. I counseled them not to get overly excited. It was early in the trial, and eyewitnesses like Schaefer were usually the easiest to handle and damage on the stand. There were still tough witnesses and tougher days ahead. They could count on that.
I don't care, Lisa said. You were marvelous, and that lying bitch got just what she deserved.
The invective was dripping with hate, and it made me pause for a moment before responding. The prosecutor is still going to have a chance to rehabilitate her on redirect after lunch.
And then you can destroy her again on recross.
Well, I don't know about destroying anybody. That's not what...
Can you join us for lunch, Mickey?
She punctuated the request by swinging her arm around Dahl, clearly showing what I had been assuming, that they were together in more than just business.
There is nothing good around here, she continued. We're going down to Ventura Boulevard to find a place. We might even try Danny's Deli.
Thank you, but no. I need to get back to the office and meet with my crew. They're not here because they can't be. They're working, and I need to check in. Lisa gave me a look that told me she didn't believe me. It didn't much matter to me. I represented her in court. It didn't mean I had to eat with her, and the man I was still sure was scheming to rip her off, no matter the romantic entanglement. If it even was romantic. I headed out on my own and walked back to my office in the Victory Building. Lorna had already gone to the competing and far better Jerry's Famous Deli in Studio City and picked up turkey and coleslaw sandwiches. I ate at my desk while telling Cisco and Bullocks what had happened that morning in court.
Despite my reserve with my client, I felt pretty good about my cross with Schaefer. I thanked Bullocks for the display board, which I believed had impressed the jury. Nothing like a visual aid to help throw doubt on a supposed eyewitness. When I finished recounting the trial testimony, I asked them what they had been working on. Sisko said he was still reviewing the police investigation, looking for errors and assumptions made by the detectives that could be turned against Curlin during cross-examination.
Good. I need all the ammo I can get, I said. Bullocks, anything from your end?
I pretty much spent the morning with the foreclosure file. I want to be bulletproof when it's my turn.
Okay, good. But you've got some time there. My guess is the defense won't start until next week. Freeman looks like she's trying to keep a certain rhythm and momentum going. But she's got a lot of witnesses on her list, and it doesn't look like a lot of smoke.
Often, prosecutors and defense attorneys pad their witness lists to keep the other side guessing as to who would actually get called and who is important in terms of testimony. It didn't appear to me that Freeman had engaged in this sort of subterfuge. Her list was lean, and every name on it had something to bring to the case. I dipped my sandwich into some Thousand Island dressing that had dripped onto the paper wrapper. Aronson pointed to one of the display boards I had brought back with me from court. It was the ground-level shot I had tried to fool Margot Schaefer with.
Wasn't that risky? What if Freeman hadn't objected?
I knew she would. And if she didn't, the judge would have. They don't like you trying to trick witnesses like that.
Yeah, but then the jury knows you're lying.
I wasn't lying. I asked the witness a question. Could she point out where Lisa was in the photo? I didn't say Lisa was in the photo. If she had been given the opportunity to answer, the answer would have been no. That's all.
Aronson frowned. Remember what I said, Bullocks. Don't grow a conscience. We're playing hardball here. I played Freeman, and she's trying to play me. Maybe she already has played me in some way, and I don't even know it. I took a risk and got a little hand slap from the judge. But every person on that jury was looking at that photo while we were at sidebar, and every one of them was thinking how hard it would have been for Margot Schaefer to see what she claims she saw. That's how it works. It's cold and calculating. Sometimes you win a point, but most times you don't.
I know, she said dismissively. It doesn't mean I have to like it.
No, you don't.
Chapter 24. Freeman surprised me after lunch by not calling Margot Schaefer back to the stand to try to repair the damage I had inflicted on Cross. My guess was that she had something else planned for later that would help salvage the Schaefer testimony. Instead, she called LAPD Sergeant David Covington, who was the first officer to respond to Westland National after the 911 call from Ricky Sanchez was logged. Covington was a seasoned veteran and a solid witness for the prosecution. In the precise, if not droll, delivery of someone who has seen more dead bodies and testified about them more times than he can remember, he described arriving on scene and determining that the victim was dead by means of foul play. He then described closing access to the entire garage, corralling Ricky Sanchez and other possible witnesses, and cordoning off the second floor area where the body was located. Through Covington, the crime scene photographs were introduced and displayed in all their bloody glory on the two overhead flat screens. These, more than any testimony from Covington, established the crime of murder, a requirement for conviction. I'd had marginal success during a pre-trial skirmish involving the crime scene photos. I had objected to their introduction, particularly the prosecution's plan to display 3x3 blow-ups on easels in front of the jury box. I had argued that they were prejudicial to my client. Photos of real victims of murder are always shocking and provoke strong emotions. It is human nature to want to harshly punish those responsible. Photos can easily turn a jury against the accused, regardless of what evidence connects the accused to the crime. Perry tried to split the baby. He limited the number of photos the prosecution could introduce to 4 and told Freeman she had to use the overhead screens, thus limiting the size of the photos. I had won a few points, but knew that the judge's order would not limit the visceral response of the jurors. It was still a victory for the prosecution.
Freeman chose the four photos that showed the most blood, and the pitiful angle at which Bondurant had dropped face first onto the concrete floor of the garage. On cross-examination, I zeroed in on one photo and tried to get the jury thinking about something other than avenging the dead. The best way to do that is to plant questions. If they are left with questions but no answers, then I've done my job on cross. With the judge's permission, I used the projection remote to eliminate three of the photos on the screens, leaving only one remaining. Sergeant Covington, I want to draw your attention to the photo I've left on display. I believe it is marked People's Exhibit 3. Can you tell me what that is in the foreground of the photo?
Yes, that is an open briefcase.
Okay, and is that how you found it when you arrived at the scene?
Yes, it is.
It was sitting there, open like that?
Yes.
Okay, and did you make any inquiry of any witness or anyone else to determine if someone had opened it after the victim was discovered?
I asked the woman who had called 911 if she had opened it, and she said she had not.
That was the extent of my inquiry on it. I left it for the detectives. Okay, and you've testified here that you have been working patrol for your entire career of 22 years, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
You have responded to a lot of 911 calls.
Yes.
What did seeing that open briefcase mean to you?
Nothing, really. It was just part of the crime scene.
Did your experience cause you to think there may have been a robbery involved in this murder?
Not really. I'm not a detective.
If robbery was not a motive in this crime, why would the killer take the time to open the victim's briefcase? Freeman objected before Covington could answer. She said that the question was beyond the witness's scope of expertise and experience. Sergeant Covington has spent his entire career working patrol. He is not a detective. He has never investigated a robbery.
The judge nodded in agreement.
I tend to agree with Ms. Freeman, Mr. Haller.
Your Honor, Sergeant Covington may not have ever been a detective, but I think it is safe to say he has responded to robbery calls and conducted preliminary investigations. I think he can certainly answer a question about his initial impressions of the crime scene.
I'm still going to sustain the objection. Ask your next question.
Defeated on that point, I looked down at the notes I had previously worked up for Covington. I felt confident that I had firmly planted the question about robbery and the motive for the murder in the jurors' minds. But I didn't want to leave it at that. I decided to try a bluff. Sergeant, after you arrived in response to the 911 call and surveyed the crime scene, did you call for investigators and medical examiners and crime scene experts?
Yes, I contacted the comms center, confirming that we had a homicide and requesting the usual response of investigators from Van Nuys' division.
And you maintained control of the crime scene until those people arrived?
Yes, that is how it works. I transferred custody of the scene to the investigators, Detective Curlin, to be exact.
Okay, and at any time during this process, did you discuss with Curlin or any other law enforcement officer the possibility that the murder had come out of a robbery attempt?
No, I did not.
Are you sure, Sergeant?
Quite sure.
I wrote something down on my legal pad. It was a meaningless scribble done for the jury. I have no further questions. Covington was excused, and one of the paramedics who had responded to the 911 call testified about confirming that the victim was dead at the scene. He was on and off the stand in 5 minutes, as Freeman was interested only in confirming death, and I had nothing to gain from cross-examination. Next up was the victim's brother, Nathan Bondurant. He was used to confirm identification of the victim, another requirement for conviction. Freeman also used him much as she did the crime scene photos, to stir emotions in the jury. He tearfully described being taken by detectives to the medical examiner's office, where he identified his younger brother's body. Freeman asked him when he had last seen his brother alive, and his answer brought another torrent of tears as he described attending a Lakers basketball game together just a week before the murder. It's a rule of thumb to leave a crying man alone. There usually isn't anything to be gained from cross-examining a victim's loved one.
but Freeman had opened a door, and I decided to step through it. The risk I ran was that jurors might view me as being cruel if I went too far in questioning the bereaved family member.
Mr. Bondurant, I'm sorry for your family's loss. I only have a few quick questions. You mentioned that you and your brother went to the Lakers game a week before this horrible crime occurred. What did you talk about during that outing?
We talked about a lot of things. It would be hard to remember everything right now.
Only sports and Lakers?
No, of course not. We were brothers. We talked about a lot of things. He asked about my kids. I asked if he was seeing anyone. Things like that.
Was he seeing anyone?
No, not at the time. He said he was too busy with work.
What else did he say about work?
He just said it was busy. He was in charge of home loans and it was a bad time. A lot of foreclosures and all of that sort of stuff. He didn't really get into it.
Did he talk about his own real estate holdings and what was happening with them?
Freeman objected on relevance. I asked for a sidebar, and it was granted. At the bench, I argued that I had already put the jury on notice that I would not only be debunking the state's case, but putting forward a defense case that included evidence of an alternate theory of the crime. This is that alternate theory, Judge. That Bondurant was in trouble financially, and his efforts to get out of the hole brought about his demise. I should be given the latitude to pursue this with any witness the prosecution puts before the jury.
Judge, Freeman countered, just because counsel says something is relevant doesn't mean it is. The victim's brother has no direct knowledge of Mitchell Bondurant's financial or investment situation.
If that's the case, Judge, Nathan Bondurant can say so and I'll move on.
Very well, overruled. Ask your question, Mr. Haller.
Back at the lectern, I asked the witness the question again. He spoke very briefly, without going into detail about it, the witness replied.
What exactly did he say?
He just said that he was upside down on his investment properties. He didn't say how many that was or how much was involved. That was all he said.
What did that mean to you when he said he was upside down?
That he owed more on his properties than they were worth.
Did he say he was trying to sell them?
He said he couldn't sell them without taking a bath.
Thank you, Mr. Bondurant. I have no further questions.
Freeman completed her tour of minor players by calling a witness named Gladys Pickett, who identified herself on the stand as the head teller at Westland National's main branch in Sherman Oaks. After eliciting from Pickett what her duties were at the bank, Freeman got right down to the salient testimony. As the person in charge of the tellers at the bank, you have how many people reporting to you, Mrs. Pickett?
About 40 altogether.
Is one of those people a teller named Margot Schaefer?
Yes, Margot is one of my tellers.
I would like to draw your attention back to the morning of Mitchell Bondurant's murder. Did Margot Schaefer come to you with a particular concern?
Yes, she did.
Can you please tell the jury what Miss Schaefer was concerned about?
She came to me and reported that she had seen Lisa Trammell just a half block from the bank, walking down the sidewalk and moving in a direction away from the bank.
Why was this a concern?
Well, we have Lisa Trammell's photograph up in the employees' lounge and inside our vault, and we have been instructed to report any sighting of Lisa Trammell to our supervisors.
Do you know why this instruction was put in place?
Yes, the bank has a restraining order keeping her away from the property.
Can you tell the jury what time it was when Margot Schaefer told you about seeing Ms. Trammell near the bank?
Yes, it was as soon as she came into work that day. It was the first thing she did.
Now, do you keep a record of when tellers arrive at work?
I keep a checkout list in the vault on which the time is posted.
This is when tellers come into the vault and get their money boxes to take to their stations.
Yes, that's right.
On the day in question, what time do you show Margot Schaefer's name being checked off?
It was 9:09. She was the last one checked in. She was late.
And would that have been when she told you about seeing Lisa Trammell?
Yes, precisely.
Now, at that time, did you know that Mitchell Bondurant had been murdered in the bank's garage?
No, no one knew that yet, because Ricky Sanchez had stayed in the garage until the police came, and then they kept her there for questioning. We didn't know what was going on.
So the idea that Margot Schaefer would have concocted the story about seeing Lisa Trammell after hearing about Mr. Bondurant's murder is not possible, correct?
Correct.
She told me about seeing her before she or I or anybody in the bank knew about Mr. Bondurant. So at what point did you learn of Mr. Bondurant's murder in the garage and offer the information you had received from Margot Schaefer?
That was about a half hour later.
That's when we heard, and I obviously thought the police needed to know that this woman had been seen nearby.
Thank you, Mrs. Pickett. I have no further questions.
It was Freeman's biggest hit so far. Pickett had successfully undone much of what I had been able to accomplish with Schaefer on the stand. Now I had to decide whether to leave it alone or risk making things worse. I decided to cut my losses and move on. They say never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. The rule applied here. Pickett had refused to talk to my investigator. Freeman could be setting a trap, leaving her up there with one more piece of information I might stumble into with an ill-advised question. I have no questions for this witness, I said from my place at the defense table. Judge Perry excused Pickett and called for the afternoon break of 15 minutes. As people stood to leave the courtroom, my client leaned into me at the table.
Why didn't you go after her? She whispered.
Who, Pickett? I didn't want to make it worse by asking the wrong thing.
Are you kidding me? You needed to destroy her, like you did Schaefer.
The difference was I had something to work with on Schaefer. I didn't have it on Pickett, and going after somebody with nothing to go after her with is potential disaster. I left it alone. I could see anger darkening her eyes. Well, you should have gotten something on her. It came out as a hiss through what I believed were clenched teeth. Look, Lisa, I am your attorney, and I decide, never mind, I have to go. She stood up and hurried through the gate toward the courtroom exit. I glanced over to Freeman to see if she had caught the display of attorney-client disagreement. She gave me a knowing smile, indicating she had. I decided to go out into the hall to see why my client had so abruptly needed to leave. I stepped out and was immediately drawn by the cameras to one of the benches that ran along the hallway between courtroom doors. The focus was on Lisa, who was sitting on the bench hugging her son, Tyler. The boy looked extremely uncomfortable in the camera lights. Jesus Christ, I whispered. I saw Lisa's sister standing on the periphery of the group and walked over. What is this, Jody? She knows the judge ruled she can't have the kid in court.
I know. He's not going into the courtroom. He had a half day at school and she wanted me to bring him by. She thought if the media saw her with Ty that it might help things, I guess.
Yeah, well, the media's got nothing to do with this. Don't bring him back. I don't care what she says. Don't bring him back. I looked around for Herb Dahl. This had to be his move, and I wanted to deliver the same message to him. But there was no sign of the erstwhile Hollywood player. He had probably been smart enough to stay clear of me. I headed back into the courtroom. I still had 10 minutes of the break left and planned to use it brooding about working for a client I didn't like and was beginning to despise. Chapter 25. After the break, Freeman moved on to what I call the hunter-gatherer stage of the prosecution's case. The crime scene technicians. Their testimony would be the platform on which she would present Detective Howard Curlin, the lead investigator. The first hunter-gatherer was a coroner's investigator named William Abbott, who had responded to the crime scene and was charged with the body's documentation and transport to the medical examiner's office, where the autopsy would be conducted. His testimony covered his observations of the crime scene, the head wounds sustained by the victim, and the personal property found on the body. This included Bondurant's wallet, watch, loose change, and a money clip containing $183 in currency.
There was also the receipt from the Joe's Joe franchise that had helped investigators set the time of death. Abbott, like Covington before him, was very matter-of-fact in his testimony. Being at the scene of a violent crime was routine for him. When it was my turn to ask the questions, I zeroed in on this. Mr. Abbott, how long have you been a coroner's investigator?
I'm going on 29 years now.
All with L.A. County?
That's right.
How many murder scenes do you estimate you have been to in that time?
Oh, gee, probably a couple thousand, a lot.
I bet, and I assume many were scenes where great violence was involved.
That's the nature of the beast.
What about this scene? You examined and photographed the wounds on the victim, correct?
Yes, I did. That is part of the protocol we follow before transporting the body.
You have a crime scene report in front of you that was admitted into evidence by pretrial agreement. Could you read the second paragraph of the summary to the jury? Abbott turned the page on his report and found the paragraph.
There are three distinct impact wounds on the crown of the head, noted for their violence and damage. Positioning of the body indicates immediate loss of consciousness before impact on the ground. Then in parentheses I have the word overkill.
Yes, I'm curious about that. What did you mean by putting overkill in the summary?
Just that it looked to me like any one of these impacts would have done the job. The victim was unconscious and possibly even dead before he hit the ground. The first blow did that. This would indicate that two of the impacts came after he was face down on the ground. It was overkill. Somebody was very angry at him is the way I was looking at it.
Abbott probably thought he was smartly giving me the answer I most didn't want to hear. Freeman, too. But they were wrong. So you were indicating in your summary that you detected there was some sort of emotional involvement in this murder, correct?
Yes, that is what I was thinking.
What kind of training do you have in terms of homicide investigation?
Well, I trained for 6 months before starting the job way back 30 years ago. And we have ongoing in-service training a couple of times a year. We're taught the latest investigative techniques and so forth.
Is this specific to homicide investigation?
Not all of it, but a lot of it is.
Isn't it a basic tenet of homicide that a crime of overkill usually indicates that the victim knew his or her killer? That there was a personal relationship? Freeman finally got it. She stood and objected, saying that Abbott was not a homicide investigator, and the question called for expertise he did not have. I didn't have to argue. The judge held his hand up to stop me from speaking and told Freeman that I had just walked Abbott down the path without objection from the state. The investigator had testified to his experience and training in the area of homicide without a peep from Freeman.
You gambled, Ms. Freeman. You thought it was going to cut your way. You can't back out now. The witness will answer the question.
Go ahead, Mr. Abbott, I said. Abbott stalled by asking for the question to be read to him by the court stenographer. He then had to be prompted again by the judge.
There is that consideration, he finally said.
Consideration? I asked. What does that mean?
When you have a crime of high violence, it should be considered that the victim personally knew his attacker, his killer.
When you say crime of high violence, do you mean overkill?
That could be part of it, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Abbott. Now, what about other observations you made at the crime scene? Did you form any opinion in regard to the kind of power it took to make these three brutal strikes on the top of Mr. Bondurant's head? Freeman objected again, stating that Abbott was not a medical examiner and did not have the expertise to answer the question. This time, Perry sustained the objection, giving her a small victory. I decided to take what I had gotten and be happy with it. No further questions, I said. Next up was Paul Roberts, who is the senior criminalist in the three-member LAPD crime scene unit that processed the scene. His testimony was less eventful than Abbott's, because Freeman kept him on a short leash. He spoke only of procedures and what he collected at the scene, and processed later in the SID lab. On cross, I was able to use the paucity of physical evidence to my client's advantage. Can you tell the jury the locations of the fingerprints you collected from the scene that were later matched to the defendant?
There were none that we found.
Can you tell the jury what samples of blood collected at the scene came from the defendant?
There was none that we found.
Well then, what about hair and fiber evidence? Surely you connected the defendant to the crime scene through hair and fiber evidence, correct?
We did not.
I took a few steps away from the lectern, as if walking off my frustration, and then came back.
Mr. Haller, the judge said, let's skip the play acting.
Thank you, Your Honor, Freeman said.
I wasn't addressing you, Ms. Freeman.
I looked at the jury for a long moment before asking my next and final question.
In summary, sir, did you and your team gather a single shred of evidence in that garage that connects Lisa Trammell to the crime scene?
In the garage? No, we didn't.
Thank you. Then I have nothing further.
I knew that Freeman could hit back hard on redirect by asking Roberts about the hammer with Bondurant's blood on it and the shoe with the same blood on it found in my client's garage. He was part of the crime scene crews that handled both places. But I was guessing she wouldn't do it. She had choreographed the delivery of her case to the last piece of evidence, and to change things now would be to knock the case out of rhythm, threatening her momentum and the ultimate impact when all things came together. She was too good to risk that. She would take her lumps now, knowing that she would eventually deliver the knockout punch later in the trial.
Ms. Freeman, redirect? The judge asked, once I had returned to my seat.
No, Your Honor, no redirect.
The witness may step down.
I had Freeman's witness list stapled to the inside flap of a case file on the table in front of me. I drew a line through the names Abbott and Roberts, and scanned the names that were left. The first day of trial wasn't even quite over, and she had already put a sizable dent into the list. I scanned the remaining names and determined that Detective Curlin was most likely the next witness up. But this presented a bit of a problem for the prosecutor. I checked my watch. It was 4:25, and court was scheduled to end at 5. If Freeman put Curlin on the stand, she would just be getting started when the judge recessed for the day. It was possible she could lead him toward a revelation that would be nice to have the jury considering overnight, but this might entail shuffling the delivery of his testimony, and again, I didn't think Freeman would consider it a worthy trade. I scanned the list again to see if she had a floater, a witness who could be dropped in anywhere in the prosecution's case. I didn't see one, and looked across the aisle at the prosecutor, unsure what move she would make.
Ms. Freeman, the judge prompted, call your next witness, please.
Freeman rose from her seat and addressed Perry.
Your Honor, it is expected that the witness I plan to call next will be providing lengthy testimony on both direct and cross-examination. I would like to ask for the court's indulgence and allow me to call the witness first thing in the morning so that the jury will not feel a disruption in testimony.
The judge looked over Freeman's head at the clock on the rear wall of the courtroom. He slowly shook his head.
No, he said. No, we're not going to do that. We have more than a half hour of court time left, and we are going to use it. Call your next witness, Miss Freeman.
Yes, Your Honor, Freeman said. The people call Gilbert Modesto.
I had been wrong about the floater. Modesto was head of corporate security at Westland National, and Freeman must have believed his testimony could be dropped into the trial at any point and not be detrimental to momentum and flow. After being sworn in and taking his seat on the stand, Modesto proceeded to outline his experience in law enforcement and his current duties at Westland National. Freeman then brought the questioning around to his actions on the morning of Mitchell Bondurant's slaying.
When I heard it was Mitch, the first thing I did was pull the threat file to give to the police, he said.
What is the threat file? Freeman asked.
It's a file we keep that contains every mailed or emailed threat to the bank or bank personnel. It also contains notes on any other kind of threat that comes in through phone or third party or the police. We have a protocol for weighing the severity of the threat, and we have names that we flag and so forth.
How familiar are you personally with the threat file?
Very familiar. I study it. It's my job.
How many names were in that file on the morning of Mitchell Bondurant's murder?
I didn't count, but I would say a couple dozen.
And these were all considered legitimate threats to the bank and its employees?
No. Our rule is that if we get a threat, it goes into the file. Doesn't matter how legitimate it is. It goes into the file. So most of them are not considered serious. Just somebody blowing off steam or a little frustration.
In the file that morning, what name was on the top of the list in terms of seriousness of the threat?
The defendant, Lisa Trammell. Freeman paused for effect. I studied the jury. Almost all eyes looked toward my client.
Why is that, Mr. Modesto? Did she make a specific threat against the bank or any bank employee?
No, she didn't. But she was engaged in a foreclosure fight with the bank, and had a history of protesting outside the bank until her lawyers got a temporary restraining order keeping her away. It was her actions that were perceived as a threat, and it looks like we were right about that.
I jumped up and objected, asking the judge to strike the end of Modesto's answer as being inflammatory and prejudicial. The judge agreed, and admonished Modesto to keep such opinions to himself. Do you know, Mr. Modesto, Freeman said, whether Lisa Trammell had made a direct threat against anyone at the bank, including Mitchell Bondurant?
Rule number one was to turn all weaknesses into advantages. Freeman was asking my questions now, robbing me of the chance to inflect them with my own outrage. No, not specifically, but it was our feeling in terms of threat assessment that she was someone we should keep an eye out for.
Thank you, Mr. Modesto. Who did you give this file to within the LAPD?
Detective Curlin, who was heading up the investigation. I went directly to him with it.
And did you have occasion to speak to Detective Curlin again later in the day?
Well, we spoke a few times as the investigation was progressing. He had questions about the surveillance cameras in the garage and other things.
Was there a second time when you contacted him?
Yes, when it came to my attention that one of our employees, a teller, had reported to her supervisor that she believed she had seen Lisa Trammell either near or on the bank property that morning. I thought that was information that police needed to have, so I called Detective Curlin and set up an interview for him with the teller.
And was that Margot Schaefer?
Yes, it was.
Freeman ended her direct examination there and turned the witness over to me. I decided it would be best to get in and out, sow a few seeds, and come back to harvest later.
Mr. Modesto, as chief of corporate security at Westland, did you have access to the foreclosure action the bank was taking against Lisa Trammell? Modesto emphatically shook his head. No, that was a legal case, and as such I was not privy to it.
So when you gave Detective Curlin that file with Lisa Trammell's name at the top of the list, you wouldn't have known if she was about to lose her house or not, correct?
That is correct.
You wouldn't have known if the bank was in the process of backing off her foreclosure because it had employed a company engaged in fraudulent activities, am I?
Objection! Freeman shrieked. Assumes facts not in evidence.
Sustained, Perry said. Mr. Haller, be careful here.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Modesto, at the time you gave the threat file to Detective Curlin, did you mention Lisa Trammell specifically, or did you just hand him the file and let him go through it on his own?
I told him she was on the top of our list.
Did he ask you why?
I don't really recall. I just remember telling him about her, but I can't say for sure whether that was volunteered by me or whether he asked me specifically.
And at the time you spoke to Detective Curlin about Lisa Trammell as being a threat, you had no idea what the status of her foreclosure case was, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So Detective Curlin didn't have that information either, am I right?
I can't speak for Detective Curlin. You would have to ask him.
Don't worry, I will. I have no further questions at this time. I checked the back wall as I returned to my seat. It was 5 minutes before five, and I knew we were finished for the day. There was always so much that went into prepping for a trial. The end of the first day usually was accompanied by a wave of fatigue. I was just feeling it start to hit me.
The judge admonished the jurors to keep an open mind about what they had heard and seen during the day. He told them to avoid media reports on the trial and not to discuss the case among themselves or with others. He then sent them home. My client went off with Herb Dahl, who had returned to the courthouse, and I followed Freeman through the gate. "Nice start," I said to her. "Not bad yourself." "Well, we both know you get to pick off the low-hanging fruit at the beginning of a trial. Then it's gone, and it gets tough." "Yes, it's going to get tough. Good luck, Holler." Once in the hallway, we went our separate ways. Freeman down the stairs to the DA's office, and me to the elevator, and then back to my office. It didn't matter how tired I was. I still had work to do. Curlin would likely be on the stand all day the next day. I was going to be ready. Chapter 26. The people call Detective Howard Curlin. Andrea Freeman turned from the prosecution table where she stood and smiled at the detective as he walked down the aisle, two impressively thick blue binders known as murder books under his arm. He came through the gate and headed toward the witness stand. He looked at ease. This was routine for him. He put the murder books down on the shelf in front of the witness chair and raised his hand to take the oath. He shot me a sideways look at that point. Outwardly, Curlin looked cool, calm, and collected, but we had done this dance before, and he had to be wondering what I would be bringing this time. Curlin wore a sharply cut navy blue suit with a bright orange tie. Detectives always put on their best look to testify. Then I realized something else. There was no gray in Curlin's hair. He was closing in on 60 and had no gray. He had dyed it for the TV cameras. Vanity. I wondered if it was something I could use as an edge when it was my turn to ask him questions. After Curlin was sworn in, he took the witness seat and made himself comfortable. He'd probably be there the whole day, and maybe longer. He poured himself a glass of water from the pitcher set up by the judge's clerk, took a sip, and looked at Freeman. He was ready to go. "Good morning, Detective Curlin. I would like to start this morning with you telling the jury a little bit about your experience and history."
"I'd be glad to," Curlin said with a warm smile. "I'm 56 years old, and I joined the LAPD 24 years ago, after spending 10 years in the Marines. I've been a homicide detective assigned to the Van Nuys Division for the past 9 years. Before that, I spent 3 years working homicides at the Foothill Division."
"How many homicide investigations have you worked?"
"This case is my 61st homicide. I was a detective assigned to investigations of other crimes, robbery, burglary, and auto theft, for 6 years before moving to homicide." Freeman was standing at the lectern. She flipped back a page on a legal pad, ready to move on to what mattered.
"Detective, let's begin on the morning of the murder of Mitchell Bondurant. Can you walk us through the initial stages of the case?"
Smart move, saying us, and implying that the jury and prosecutor were part of the same team. I had no doubts about Freeman's skills, and she would be at her sharpest with her lead detective on the stand. She knew that if I could damage Curlin, the whole thing might come tumbling down. "I was at my desk at about 9:15, when the detective lieutenant came to me and my partner, Detective Cynthia Longstreth, and said a homicide had occurred in the parking garage of the Westland National Headquarters on Ventura Boulevard. Detective Longstreth and I immediately rolled on it."
"You went to the scene?"
"Yes, immediately. We arrived at 9:30 and took control of the scene."
"What did that entail?"
"Well, the first priority is to preserve and collect the evidence from the crime scene. The patrol officers had already taped off the area and were keeping people away. Once we were satisfied that everything was covered there, we divvied up responsibilities. I left my partner in charge of overseeing the crime scene investigation, and I would conduct preliminary interviews of the witnesses the patrol officers were holding for questioning."
"Detective Longstreth is a less experienced detective than you, correct?"
"Yes, she's been working homicide investigations with me for 3 years."
Why did you give the junior member of your team the very important job of overseeing the crime scene investigation?
I did it that way because I knew that the crime scene people and the coroner's investigator who were on the scene were all veterans with many years on the job, and that Cynthia would be with good, experienced hands.
Freeman then led Curlin through a series of questions about his interviews with the gathered witnesses, starting with Ricky Sanchez, who had discovered the body and called 911. Curlin was at ease on the stand, and almost folksy in his delivery. The word that came to mind was charming. I didn't like charming, but I had to bide my time. I knew it might be the end of the day before I got the chance to go after Curlin. In the meantime, I had to hope that by then the jury hadn't fallen completely in love with him. Freeman was smart enough to know you can't keep a jury's attention with charm alone. Eventually, she moved out of the scene-setting preliminaries and started to deliver the case against Lisa Trammell. Detective, was there a time during the investigation when the defendant's name became known to you?
Yes, there was. The bank's head of security came to the garage and asked to see me or my partner. I spoke to him briefly and then accompanied him to his office, where we reviewed video from the cameras located at the vehicle entrance and exits to the garage and in the elevators.
And did the review of those videos provide you with any investigative leads?
Nothing initially. I saw no one carrying a weapon or acting in a suspicious way before or after the approximate time of the murder. Nobody running from the garage. There was nothing suspicious about the vehicles going in and out. Of course, we would run every license plate, but there was nothing on video upon that initial viewing that helped us, and, of course, the actual murder itself was not captured by any camera. That was another detail that the perpetrator of the crime seemed to be aware of. I rose and objected to Curlin's last line, and the judge struck it from the record and told the jury to ignore it.
Detective, Freeman prompted, I believe you were going to tell us how Lisa Trammell's name first came up in the investigation.
Yes, right. Well, Mr. Modesto, the bank security chief, also provided me with a file, what he called the threat assessment file. He turned that over to me and it contained several names, including the name of the defendant. Then, just a short while later, Mr. Modesto called me and informed me that Lisa Trammell, one of the people listed in the file, happened to be seen that morning in close proximity to the bank.
The defendant. And so this was how her name came up in the investigation, correct?
Correct.
What did you do with this information, Detective?
I first returned to the crime scene. I then sent my partner to interview the witness who said she saw Lisa Trammell near the bank. It was important that we confirm that sighting and get the details. I then began to go through the threat assessment file to study all of the names and details of the perceived threats.
And did you draw any immediate conclusions?
I didn't believe there was any individual listed who would immediately jump to the level of a person of interest based solely on what was reported in the file about them and their disputes with the bank. Obviously, they would all have to be looked at carefully. However, Lisa Trammell did rise to the level of being a person of interest, because I knew from Mr. Modesto that she had allegedly been seen in the vicinity of the bank at the time of the murder.
So Lisa Trammell's time and geographic proximity to the murder was a key to your thinking at this point?
Yes, because proximity could mean access. It appeared from the crime scene that someone had been waiting for the victim to show up. He had an assigned parking space with his name on the wall. There was a large support column next to the space. Our initial theory was that the killer had hidden behind the column and waited for Mr. Bondurant to pull in and park. It appeared that he was struck the first time from behind, just as he left his car.
Thank you, Detective. Freeman led her witness through a few more of the steps taken at the crime scene, before bringing the focus back to Lisa Trammell. Did your partner return to the crime scene at some point to report back about her interview with a bank employee who claimed to have seen Lisa Trammell near the bank?
Yes, she did. My partner and I felt that the identification made by the witness was solid. We then discussed Lisa Trammell and the need for us to speak to her quickly.
But, Detective, You had a crime scene investigation underway, and a file full of the names of people who had made threats against the bank or its employees. Why the urgency involving Lisa Trammell?
Curlin leaned back in his witness chair and adopted the pose of a wise and wily old veteran.
Well, there were a couple of things that gave us a sense of urgency in regard to Miss Trammell. First of all, her dispute with the bank was over the foreclosure of her property. That put her dispute specifically in the home loan division. The victim, Mr. Bondurant, was a senior vice president directly in charge of the home loan division. So we were looking at that connection. Additionally, and more importantly...
Let me interrupt you there, Detective. You called that a connection. Did you know if the victim and Lisa Trammell knew each other?
Not at that point, no. What we knew was that Miss Trammell had a history of protesting the foreclosure of her home, and that the foreclosure action was initiated by Mr. Bondurant, the victim. But we did not know at that time whether these two people knew each other, or had ever even met. It was a smooth move, bringing out the deficiencies in her case to the jury before I did. It made it harder for the defense to make its case.
Okay, Detective, Freeman said. I interrupted you when you were going to tell us a second reason for having some urgency in regard to Miss Trammell.
What I wanted to explain is that a murder investigation is a fluid situation. You must move carefully and cautiously, but at the same time, you must go where the case takes you. If you don't, then evidence could be at risk, and possibly other victims. We felt there was a need to make contact with Lisa Trammell at this point in the investigation. We couldn't wait. We could not give her time to destroy evidence or harm other persons. We had to move. I checked the jury. Curlin was giving one of his best performances ever. He held every eye in the jury box. If Clegg McReynolds ever made a movie, maybe Curlin should play himself.
So what did you do, Detective?
We ran a check on Lisa Trammell's driver's license, got her address in Woodland Hills, and proceeded to her home.
Who was left at the crime scene?
Several people. Our coordinator and all the SID techs and the coroner's people. They still had a lot to do, and we were waiting on them anyway. Going to Lisa Trammell's house in no way compromised the scene or the investigation.
Your coordinator? Who's that?
The Detective 3 in charge of the homicide unit, Jack Newsom. He was the supervisor on scene.
I see. So what happened when you got to Ms. Trammell's home? Was she there?
Yes, she was. We knocked, and she answered.
Can you take us through what happened next?
We identified ourselves and said we were conducting an investigation of a crime. Didn't say what it was, just said it was serious. We asked if we could come inside to ask her a few questions. She said yes, so we entered. I felt a vibration in my pocket and knew I had received a text on my cell phone. I slipped it out of my pocket and held it down below the table so the judge would not see it. The message was from Cisco. Need to talk. Show you something. I texted back, and we had a quick digital conversation. You verify the letter? No, something else. Still working the letter. Then after court, get me the letter. I put the phone away and went back to watching Freeman's direct examination. The letter in question had come in the afternoon before in the mail to my P.O. box. It came anonymously, but if its contents could be confirmed by Cisco, I would have a new weapon. A powerful weapon.
What was Ms. Trammell's demeanor when you met her?
Freeman asked. She seemed pretty calm to me, Curlin said. She didn't seem particularly curious about why we wanted to talk to her or what the crime was. She was nonchalant about the whole thing.
Where did you and your partner speak to her?
She walked us into the kitchen where there was a table, and she invited us to sit down. She asked if we wanted water or coffee, and we both said no.
And you started asking her questions then?
Yes, we started by asking if she had been in the house all morning. She said she had been, except for when she drove her son to school in Sherman Oaks at 8. I asked if she had made any other stops on the way home, and she said no.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, that somebody was lying. We had the witness who put her near the bank at close to 9,
So somebody was wrong, or somebody was lying.
What did you do at that point?
I asked if she would be willing to come with us to the police station where she would be interviewed and asked to look at some photographs. She said yes, and we took her